Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of April 6th, 2012. Lots of older Americans went back to school hoping to land a better paying job. But now, millions of senior citizens are saddled with student loan debt.
It has helped my career, yes, and it helped me mentally, absolutely. But if I had that choice, knowing that student debt, I would never do it again. Never.
We'll hear what their options are. And weddings can get pretty pricey for more than just the bride and groom.
This whole year has been a financial bloodbath because of all of the money that's been spent on traveling and in the hotel and then the dresses and
buying a gift and on, how to spend less when toasting the happy couple. Plus the changing family dynamic when she makes more than he does.
You hate having to ask me for money.
No one wants to feel like they're being a burden or something like that. You don't have to go and say, oh, I need $20 so I can go do this.
It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from 8 p.m. The soaring cost of higher education resulted in yet another round of campus pepper spray this week. Students at Santa Monica College gathered to oppose the idea of a two-tiered pricing system for tuition. Police sprayed them to break up the protest, sending three students to the hospital. And it turns out college costs are not just a plague on the young. The Washington Post reports people age 60 and over owe about $36 billion in student loans. Some went back to school later in life. Some borrowed to help out their kids. Well, we asked Marketplace's Amy Scott to look into it for us, and she joins us now from the Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore. Hi there.
Hi, Tess.
How common is this, really, for people to still be paying off student loans this late in life?
Well, only about 5% of borrowers are 60 and over, according to recent data from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. But it's still a significant number. And, you know, you hear a lot that student loans follow you to your grave.
Right.
Because unlike most consumer debt, they're very hard to get rid of in bankruptcy. So this sort of gives a new meaning to that phrase. People are still dealing with this pretty late in life.
Wow. Well, how much of this, I guess, is people paying off their own debts versus maybe their parents who co-signed a loan for their kid, maybe?
Right. Some parents took out federal plus loans to help pay for their kid's college, or maybe co-signed on a private student loan for a kid or even a grandkid. But, you know, lots of people are going back to school later in life, both to finish college the first time around and maybe for job retraining, especially in this economy. I talked to one of those people, Faith Halpern, who lost her job in midlife, went back to get her MBA. She's been in and out of work, had to stop paying a few times. Meanwhile, the loan ballooned. And 15 years later, she says she's still paying $500 a month and barely making a dent in the principal. And, you know, I asked her if it was worth it.
It has helped my career, yes, and it helped me mentally, absolutely. But if I had that choice, knowing that student debt, I would never do it again. Never.
And, you know, Tess Halpern got her degree. A lot of these people don't finish. So they end up with all this debt and not much to show for it in the end.
Wow. Well, I suppose it's also a different situation for them versus someone who's younger because, you know, they're hoping to retire. They've got a lot less working years ahead of them.
Right. And often they have a harder time finding jobs if they're out of work. I talked with Deanne Lunan with the National Consumer Law Center. She has a lot of older clients. Many of them are struggling to pay student loans. And she says seniors are also more likely to have health problems, and they're often on fixed incomes.
The lifeline that we have for older people in this country, Social Security, can be taken by the government to collect student loan debt, or at least portions of it can be taken, which is really extraordinary. And I think it takes away some of the peace of mind people have as they get older.
And she's talking about federal student loans there. For federal loans, there's no statute of limitations. So there's no limit on how long the government can go after that debt. Lunan told me about a client she had a few years ago who took out a loan in the 1970s. He had severe health problems, was homeless for a while, so the debt really grew. And here he was 40 years later, and the government was still taking portions of his Social Security check.
Whoa. Well, as you mentioned, also the complicating factor here is that you can't just file for bankruptcy. So is there anything that people can do if they're dealing with this kind of debt? Any options?
Well, with federal student loans, you can often work out a deal to pay based on your income. So the less you make, the less you have to pay monthly. If you have a permanent disability, you can sometimes get the loan forgiven completely. With private lenders, though, it's tougher. You know, they don't have to do anything for you, but many will work with individual borrowers to lower their interest rate or to work out some kind of extended repayment plan. There is some effort in Congress to change bankruptcy laws so that at least private student loans will be treated like other forms of consumer debt so you can get out from under them in bankruptcy. But advocates of that say it's not likely to pass anytime soon.
Marketplace's Amy Scott joining us from Baltimore. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. We talk a lot about how important it is to make sure you're not paying high fees on your investments. Well, that is getting harder to do. Some brokerages are hiking the fees they get for selling particular mutual funds, and you may not even notice because you don't pay those fees directly. But now some consumer advocates are calling those payments kickbacks to brokers, and they say it can lead to a conflict of interest problem. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains.
Over the years, big financial firms have carefully cultivated the image of their stockbrokers as advisors you can trust to be on your side in ads like this, for example.
My broker says, in the long run, that kind of investment could be a good idea. What's your broker say?
But when your broker talks, how carefully should you really listen? Is he truly a trusted advisor or just a salesman hawking what will bring him the most money? Under a system known as revenue sharing, mutual funds pay brokerages to sell their particular offerings, much like some grocery stores charge to place products on the most visible shelf space. One brokerage firm reports it makes as much as half its profit from these fees. John Freeman is a business ethics professor at the University of South Carolina.
What you have is brokerage firms deciding among thousands and thousands of mutual funds which ones they want to stock, which by sheer coincidence turn out to be the ones that pay the most money to the brokerage firm for stocking them.
Mercer Bullard is founder of Fund Democracy, an investor advocacy group.
The problem is that your average consumer, when they're getting personalized professional advice, expect that person is making recommendations solely in the client's best interest. But that is not the standard that applies to brokers.
Bullard says brokers continue to fight rules that would require them to act in the best interests of their customers, something certified financial advisors are already required to do. Brokerage firms argue the payments go to their bottom lines, not individual brokers, and so don't affect an advisor's judgment. So how would you know if that's even a possibility with your broker? Barbara Roper is an investor advocate for the Consumer Federation of America. She says the broker might tuck away a disclosure online.
It is a rare investor who's going to go prospecting through the brokerage firm website to find this information.
But Mercer Bullard, who's a law professor at the University of Mississippi, suggests you could pick up the phone.
One way to protect yourself is always ask all compensation be disclosed.
Investor advocates say the Securities and Exchange Commission is still promising to make a new rule aimed at bringing greater transparency to the financial relationship between mutual funds and brokers. It's been in the works for almost a decade now. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
T-minus two, people. 2 weeks to file your taxes. If you're scrambling to get it done, well, here's a reminder. If you sold anything for a profit at a garage sale, on Craigslist, eBay, and you don't report it, that is tax evasion, my friends. And this year, changes are coming for online retailers who have flown under the radar for years. Jennifer Collins reports.
When we think of tax evasion, this guy often comes to mind.
Al Capone finds an aroused government ready to put him behind bars.
You know the story. Capone made a fortune running a vast smuggling operation during Prohibition. He was brought down, like so many other gangsters, because he didn't pay his taxes. It was tough for Capone to convince anyone that he forgot about his considerable earnings. It's a little different for smaller operations.
And this is my page. We're at She's So Crafty Goods.
Lisa Williams has been selling art and accessories online for more than 4 years. She works out of her house in a D.C. suburb.
When my son was born, I didn't really want to go back to a regular job.
Williams makes felt baby booties decorated with rosettes and tiny daisies that go for about $25 a pair.
Ta-da!
She sells them on Etsy, an online marketplace which specializes in handmade goods. Things like latte cozies knit to fit a Starbucks cup, or purses made of a hollowed-out birch log. The sellers are responsible for reporting their earnings, but many people, including Williams, start out thinking of their Etsy shops as a hobby. So when tax time comes around, they just don't file or they don't claim everything.
And I know this for a fact because sometimes you'll talk to other Etsy sellers in general who will totally say stuff like, oh, yeah, I'm not filing. I don't claim this on my taxes. Why am I claiming this on my taxes?
Consulting firm IDC says there are about 14 million home-based e-retailers in the U.S. Their ranks have grown by almost 25% since the economy took a dive. Well, it's tough to say how many fail to report income.
We believe that it's millions of taxpayers.
Florida tax attorney Martin Press says the problem's gotten worse since the recession. Etsy doesn't issue 1099s or other tax forms for its sellers, so many people don't realize they need to claim their online earnings. Others forget about the few hundred dollars they made reselling that vintage gown, and some people cheat deliberately.
More and more people are falling into this realm, and no taxes are taken out, and they don't have the money to pay at the end of the year, and they're not filing their income tax returns.
There have been major cases, like the eBay seller, who was also an IRS employee and failed to report her $40,000 side business. But Press says IRS agents rarely audit small-time offenders, so it takes some pretty glaring errors to tip them off. Things like failing to file at all, which Press says is more common than you'd think, or having someone report them. USC tax law professor Edward Kleinbard says as long as the math adds up, most small offenders never get caught.
It's understandable that some taxpayers may want to play the audit lottery because the IRS has very limited resources.
He says the government is starting to pay attention. This year, for the first time, PayPal, which processes many online payments, has started sending tax forms to sellers on sites like Etsy, Half.com, and eBay.
Nothing concentrates the mind like recognizing that the IRS already has the information.
So far, PayPal sends forms only to big sellers who have 200 transactions or bring in $20,000. That's not Lisa Williams. She says she makes far less than that.
See, I'm at 81 views already, 10 favorites and one order.
And Williams says only a pair of booties here or there falls through the cracks.
For me, I would probably say, you know, maybe $25, $30. I think that's pretty much standard for anybody.
And so far,
I've never been audited. I wear that as my badge.
And she wants to keep it that way. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Budgeting is a no-brainer for the bride and groom, but what about for all the other celebrants?
If I had thought of this 5 years ago, I could have started a savings account dedicated to friends' weddings, but I sort of was out of touch with the reality of the expense.
Multiple invites and limited cash, the strain of matrimony on your guests' wallets. Later on Marketplace Money from APM. And it's time for your letters. Joining me once again in the studio is our senior producer, Patty Hirsch, who's got this giant mailbag full of great mail.
It's a metaphorical mailbag. Yeah, we've got like a whole host of stuff, actually. Listeners coming to us through Facebook, through Twitter, through email, and even occasionally through snail mail.
All right. Well, what have folks been writing to us about this week?
Robots.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
And do they all want me replaced with one?
No. The whole point of having these robots was to consolidate your position, Tess. And, so, and that's exactly what has happened because, as several people pointed out, the robots actually read a correction to a story we did about a town called Salina, Kansas.
Right.
But they mispronounced the town's name.
Well, yes, they did.
But
if you listened to the whole show,
right, you would have heard that the robots were actually had to correct themselves, which just goes to show you have to stay with Marketplace Money right to the end.
That's right.
To the sweet end of money.
And you have to stay with real people, not robots.
Well, real people are way better than robots.
Because they screw up.
They screw up. Because they did screw up this time because the computer program that we used told them to pronounce Salina in a certain way, Salina, which is obviously wrong. So I had to then change the program to allow them to pronounce the name correctly or at least as closely as possible that we could get.
All right. So we are still in control.
I am still in control, Tess.
Oh, well then. Okay.
Which brings me to our next barrage of correspondence, which was on student debt. Right?
We have gotten a lot of mail about student debt.
Well, it's really, I mean, it's really in the air right now. I mean, as we heard at the top of the show. So, you know, a number of points were raised in these letters. So I asked Liz Weston, our favorite debt expert, to see if she could join us to help us out. So she's sitting very quietly here in the studio. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Fanny. We've heard her chuckling a little bit.
It's like a little mouse there in the corner.
You're welcome to laugh anytime you like.
Oh, good.
So last week on the show, we spoke to a woman who is preparing for this accelerated nursing program at Johns Hopkins University. $99,000 for 1 year of schooling.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And so this generated, I think, quite a bit of feedback from some folks, Patty.
Yeah, there was a number of listeners, again, wrote in about this. Daniel Scholl wrote in from Brookings, South Dakota. He's a professor at South Dakota State University. And he wondered why not consider a less prestigious program. Hmm. After all, nursing careers aren't necessarily dictated by where you go to school, which is more important for doctors and surgeons. So this whole thing about incurring vast amounts of debt wherever you are is like a big thing right now.
And
indeed, Abby Finnis wrote in from Minneapolis. She's not in the medical profession, but she is still in a big student debt hole, and she's asking for help. She got a bachelor's and then a master's, and now she owes a large chunk of change for her education. She is a public employee with a modest income, but she paid $12,000 plus in interest alone on her loans in 2011. Horrendous, right? So she says she's in, quote, how the hell am I ever going to get out of this one mode? And we've got a little bit of tape from her here.
I went to the University of Oregon for my undergraduate degree in political science. And then I went to the Humphrey Institute at the University of Minnesota for my graduate degree in urban planning. I owe $69,000 for graduate school and about $28,000 for undergrad. I basically don't have a smartphone. I keep my expenses as low as possible. I try not to let my loans control my life completely. I can do some fun things, but generally, I don't eat out a ton. I don't go out a lot. So just kind of keeping disposable income at a minimum really helps. Every now and then, there is a student loan moment. And then I just try to think that, you know, I'm making it okay right now. I can get by each month. And hopefully, it will all be forgiven at 10 years if I stay in public service or a nonprofit.
Well, I guess there's the question, Liz. You know, she's thinking that if she's in public service, these debts are going to be forgiven at some point. And I know there are some programs like that, but is that a smart approach? Or I don't know. It sounds like a gamble to me.
Well, I wish everybody who's going to school could listen to some of these stories and what life is like with that kind of debt so that they would be careful. Because, you know, we're talking about 17 and 18-year-olds signing up for vast amounts of debt without knowing what they're doing. She probably does have the out. If these are all federal loans, after 10 years of repayment, the balance should be forgiven. And that's an out if you have a lot of federal loans and a very small income. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do that. But obviously, a better course would be not to borrow so much, to have a debt load that's much more manageable so you can actually live your life once you get out of school. You know, you don't want to rack up $100,000 in debt if you're only going to make $40,000 a year. It does not make sense.
Well, here's a question for you. If you're 17, 18 years old and you're contemplating going to university and you're looking at your – I mean, my friends of mine are sort of going on tours with their kids, you know, who are that age. How do you have that conversation with your child, and how do you get that into your kid's head that they've got to be thinking about this as well? I mean, your little girl is sitting next door watching you here in the studio,
looking through the window. So listen closely.
So how do you get around that issue?
You don't have the conversation when they have the acceptance letter in their hand.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a horrible time when they've got their heart set on their dream college and you've never had the financial discussion before and you have to tell them no. That's awful. You need to start in the freshman year of high school at the very latest to start talking about what you can afford to give and what they should be thinking about in terms of how much debt they should take on. You know, you really don't want to borrow more in total than you're going to make your first year out of school. Well, that involves some research. What do you want to be? What do you want to study? This is all hard when you're 17 or 18 and have no clue, you know?
Okay. Bay, are you listening? How old is she?
She's nine.
Nine. Okay. So a few years
left. We're saving that money up.
Right. Well, Patty, I know that we also had another example come in through the mailbox this week. And I think we've got Peter Bolio on the phone from Hampton, Maine.
Yeah, Peter's got quite a story. So, Peter, are you there?
I am. Thank you.
So tell us, can you tell us a little bit about your situation? Sum it up for us.
Sure. So I'm currently a third-year medical student at the University of New England College of Osteopathic Medicine, which means I've done a four-year undergraduate degree, and I was lucky enough to do a master's degree after that. And now I have done three of my 4 years of medical school. And financially, what that's done is put me into about $440,000 worth of school loans.
Oh, holy, wow.
Oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be laughing.
Pick me up off the floor.
Yeah. And my question was really about how do I begin to wrap my mind around that number?
I don't know that any of us can, actually, quite frankly. And I actually think that the question is, did you think about this before you embarked on this?
Well, absolutely. I know. I mean, the road to becoming a physician is very well defined, has been for a long time.
But I don't ever remember hearing it costing $500,000 to become a doctor.
That's true. It's not an uncommon sum, I'll tell you, amongst my colleagues. I do have a bit of transparency. I do go to one of the most expensive medical schools in the country. So there were certainly cheaper choices had I gotten accepted to those schools. Of course, there's quite an application process. But with the competition to get into medical school and the fact that my wife was actually pregnant with our first child when I was accepted, it made sense to choose the school closest to Grandma and Grandpa. I contacted the federal government through the loan department, and they're telling me that I'm going to have to pay about $4,800 a month in student loans.
Jeez.
And, you know, that's where this issue of the income-based loan repayment program they offer is so important.
Yeah.
And, you know, we always hear on your show and other places that that potentially may go away depending on what the politicians do. So
it's
a scary time. And, you know, we have kids and I have a wife and I have a family to think about. But at the same time, I like to think that my service as a physician is one of good. It's one to help people. It's one to give back, you know, which was the goal from the beginning. And it's an unbelievable sum of money.
Yeah. Good. I'm interested in have you had this conversation? I mean, I'm sure you have, but can you give us some idea about how this conversation around your dinner table is going?
Well, I mean, obviously, I have a very supportive and loving wife. And when I decided to apply and accept to go to medical school, we had a long talk about this, you know, because we were adding 4 more years of debt, significant debt. You know, medical school is $50,000 a year, plus living expenses. So, you know, we don't, like your previous caller, we don't have frivolous spending. We don't go out and eat a lot. We don't have cable TV. We don't do any of those things that are sort of common around the American household. And, you know, we read a lot of books to our kids, and we enjoy our time together in cheap ways, I guess. But, you know, we just are very cognizant of it. We keep it out there, and it's nothing to communicate about it. But it can be a strain sometimes. But like I said, she's very loving, very kind, so it's been okay so far.
Yeah.
Let me ask a few questions. Are these all federal student loans?
A large majority are. I have $32,000 that's in a private loan that I'm continuing to pay now because I've gone through the default period. After my 5 years of residency training is up, if I haven't gone bankrupt at that point, I will have to find a hospital that's – and they are out there that is willing to give me a loan repayment program as a part of my salary.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that will make it doable. I mean, I certainly didn't write in and want to talk today because I think that vascular surgeons don't make enough money. I mean, that's not to be – you know, that's not the situation. They make a very good living, and I will as a physician if I make it through all the training. It just says something about the education system that I have to rack up $500,000 to get to the end.
Well, it sounds like you've done some research, which is good, and you know your options, and you know that when you get out, this is basically going to be a mortgage. You're going to have this debt probably for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
We all hope that you manage to sort this out, but I think what we're hearing today is you're just going to have to keep an eye on this because it's going to be weighing over you for some time.
Yep, and you know that's fine because in the end I'll be a physician, I'll be a surgeon, following my passion, helping people, and it will work out. My wife and I will continue to communicate about it, and we won't let it get ahead of us.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Peter.
Thank you so much.
And good luck.
Thank you. Bye bye.
And you know, I think his point, it doesn't just apply to medical school. It is something that you have to think about, as you were saying earlier, Liz. No matter what kind of schooling you're going into, you have got to know what that bill is going to be, and you have to think realistically about how you're going to pay it when you're done.
Thanks very much indeed, Liz.
My pleasure,
Thanks
Patty.
For coming in.
Thank you. Thank you, Patty.
Thank you, Tess. It's always a pleasure to be here. I just want to actually tell listeners that we would love to hear suggestions, ideas, situations that they're in. We want to hear from you through Facebook, through Twitter. and, of course, through email and snail mail. So please get in touch and let us have conversations about what you're having conversations about.
And you can follow Patty at Patty Hirsch. You can follow me at Radio Tess. We are about 5 years into the housing bust, and it's safe to say home ownership has lost a bit of its luster. I'm not sure we know at this point where it fits in the American dream either, but it does still hold a place in the American novel. And it's one of the main characters in Norumbega Park, a new book from author Anthony Giardina. The story takes place in 1969 New England. The plot involves Richie Palumbo and his pursuit of this one house he spots while he's on an outing. It quickly becomes the house. And the novel follows his obsession with owning it, no matter the cost.
This is a man who has a perception that his family's fate is hinging on a decision he's going to make. He's not sure at the beginning of the novel what that decision is, but he feels like there's a danger that they're going to be stuck in a kind of Italian-American working-class existence. And purely by accident, he's driving with his family into this town and sees this house. And this is something that's been coming from really his childhood, his young adulthood, a sense that what you're supposed to do as a man, as a father, is you're supposed to ascend and you're supposed to make it possible for your family to ascend. And in the novel, through a curious turn of events, he begins to see this town and this house as the means of ascension, not only for himself and his wife and them as a family, as a class, but he actually believes that this is going to change the possible future, the possible fate of his kids.
When Richie sees the upstairs for the first time, his mind kind of wanders to a time, you know, when his family is going to live there, and this is before they move in. I wonder if you could read that portion for us to get a sense of what he was instilling in this house before he even was there.
There were three bedrooms on the second floor, two on the third, where the roof sloped. He went into one of the bedrooms where their son must once have slept. A diploma from Bowdoin hung on the wall. There was a washstand and a mirror, and when Richie flicked on the light, he saw a picture of a boy and a girl dressed for a prom, the boy in a white tux, his hair in a close-cropped, post-war 1940s cut, the girl leaning down, her eyes slanted toward him, a big, secret smile on her face, as if she were already starting to undress for him. The photograph captured abandon, blondness, and wild good health. Jack will sleep here, Richie thought. Jack will wake to this, the Bowdoin diploma, the fields that stretch endlessly behind the house.
Not much expectation going on here.
Well, there is that sense that moving to this town is going to make Bowdoin possible for Jack. And there is that belief, my God, if he sleeps here, if he takes possession of this space, something becomes possible. Bowdoin becomes possible.
I guess what really attracted me to this was this notion of where we place the house in our dreams of success and what a house brings to us. Because I think that that notion, you know, was there for decades, but has really been called into question since the housing bust.
Right. And I think that at that time, it was so much more accessible. And my parents, for instance, in the mid-1960s, who were, like Richie, very working-class Italian-American people, surprised us all in the mid-1960s by taking us one day to a place in the woods that they had bought a lot, and they were going to build this beautiful house. Suddenly, my parents were displaying to me a sense of what their social ambitions were. And when it came time for me to buy a house in the late 1980s, I always assumed, okay, so I'm going to buy one house and this is going to be it for me. This is
right.
The house that's going to define me. It has now become a much more complicated issue, for instance, for my children. Are they going to be able to afford a house at all? So it almost becomes like I don't want to call it a quaint notion, but it's being called into question. Are our houses going to define us anymore the way they did, for instance, for the family in this novel?
As the family's story progresses and changes, the house is the one thing that remains a constant. And in the end, it brings something very different than what Richie initially believes it will. So what do you think the house represents?
Richie had hoped that it was going to change his family in a certain way. But both of his children make radical choices to kind of downgrade from what their expectations were. But in the end, his daughter brings to the house a Latino husband and his two children. And what Richie has in effect done is he has actually made it possible for someone else to have the ascension that his children couldn't quite achieve. And that is, for me, I guess, the most important thing about the novel, to show how this house affects this family, but affects some people beyond the family.
Where do you think the house fits now in our lives?
I think it is still a dream. And talking to my daughter and her husband, when they come to my house, I can see that they are looking around. I can see that they are trying to imagine themselves. And it's kind of wonderful to watch that this, you know, really difficult concept now in America still holds something for them. They still want that kind of space, that kind of ownership, and I hope they get it.
Anthony Giardina is an author and essayist. His latest novel is Norumbega Park. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much.
I could bring home the bacon, fry it up in a pan, or I could just bring home the bacon and let you fry it, man.
I'm sensitive to him being sensitive to it because I know that in past relationships he was the person who, you know, kind of provided for the woman in the relationship, and I know it's stressful for him to ask me for money.
The challenges facing the new female heads of house, coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. Spring has sprung, and, well, you know what that means. Wedding invitations. I've already had two in the mail, but I am old enough that they don't involve much more than attendance. Marketplace's Angela Kim, though, well, she's of the age where weddings involve much, much more than that. And she suggests that when brides and grooms are doing their planning, they spare just a thought for their guests.
I spent more than $3,000 on weddings last year. Six of my friends got married. I spent money on plane tickets, bachelorette parties, travel expenses.
And then the hotel, and then all the gifts, and make sure you get your dress and your shoes and everything. And it's a big chunk of change.
I met Gretchen Witt and Lisa Factora Borchers at the last wedding in Hawaii. We exchanged stories about financial pain involved in being a serial wedding attendee, even if you have a full-time job. Lisa, like me, went to six weddings in a year.
It was exceptional this year. All six weddings were must attend, and that's pretty rare.
Gretchen went to five weddings.
This whole year has been a financial bloodbath because of all of the money that's been spent. If I had thought of this 5 years ago, I could have started a savings account dedicated to friends' weddings, but I sort of was out of touch with the reality of the expense.
The thing is, I had saved up, just not to go to a friend's wedding in Hawaii. I'd been planning a vacation to Argentina, so when the invitation came in the mail, I was torn. My first thought was, I can't afford this. But then I thought about it. Argentina will always be there. I can always save up and go some other time. My friend's wedding, on the other hand, my new friend Gretchen put it this way.
Because it's the one time in your life you can have all the people that you love in the same place at the same time, and you probably never have that happen again until, like, your funeral.
Personal finance is about making choices in your life. Gretchen, Lisa, and I didn't have to go to these weddings, but we chose to. In some cases, they were hard choices to make. They forced us to compromise. I gave up a holiday. I burned a bunch of frequent flyer miles. I roomed with a friend, and I took buses instead of renting a car. I even held off giving a gift until after the wedding. I was inspired by Emily Post, who says giving a gift late is better than never. Lisa told me about the ways she makes it work. She and her husband have an annual tradition that keeps their budget on track.
Every December, my husband and I do a check-in with one another, and we always ask, how many weddings do we have coming up? We have a son, we have a 2-year-old, and we decide if we can go together, and then we make out our budget from there.
And she gets creative with her gifts.
Because I'm a photographer, I'll bring my camera to weddings that I'm not shooting officially, and I'll try and get a really, really great shot that I know a lot of other people can't get. You have to save money in small different ways.
The small things add up. They make it possible for us to share in our friends' happiness without drowning our own happiness in debt. And the good news is that the serial wedding season doesn't last forever. This coming summer, I just have one wedding to attend.
Angela Kim. And by the way, a fond farewell to her. She's leaving American Public Media after nearly 7 years of service. We will miss her good work and her baked goods. The latest jobs report shows unemployment is down to 8.2%. Companies added about 120,000 jobs to payrolls last month. Economists, though, they characterize that as ho-hum. One of the bright spots is, perhaps surprisingly, manufacturing. Employment in that sector is up by more than 4.5% since 2009, but many of those factory jobs require new skills.
The American dream is shaking right now.
Top 1%.
I think we're very blessed to have what we have.
The 99%.
I've never been one to look for a handout.
From our wealth and poverty desk, Mitchell Hartman reports on an inner city Chicago high school that's preparing kids for those jobs at a factory an hour away.
These machines here are precision. They want a 10-inch bore cut in a part, you know, plus or minus 2/10,000ths of an inch. We do that here.
I start at the specialty metalworking plant that Eric Anderberg runs in a light industrial park on the outskirts of Rockford, Illinois. 70 people work here on state-of-the-art computerized cutting machines. Orders are rolling in for mining equipment and giant earth movers. There's just one problem.
We're looking for people. We can't find them.
There's nearly 10% unemployment in Illinois. It's higher in Rockford, an old factory town. But skilled machine operators are scarce. When manufacturing tanked in the 80s, Rockford closed its trade school.
Manufacturing in the classroom isn't probably talked about too much. I mean, why you want to work with your hands? You want to go to college? Nothing wrong with that, but there's a very good living that can be made in the manufacturing industry. We have people here that make well over $50,000, $60,000 a year, plus their benefits.
Guys, you're running into some problems, right? So why don't we go back to the drawing here?
Actually, over in Chicago, they are talking about manufacturing in the classroom.
4.115.
And why?
Because you add 15,000 to the roughing.
I'm at Austin Polytechnical Academy on Chicago's west side. It's an advanced manufacturing magnet school that teaches everything from engineering and English composition to modern factory skills. The goal is to prepare Austin's 240 students, primarily African American, most from poor families, to go on to a 2-year associate's degree, if not 4-year college. Or land a well-paying job as a skilled machine operator, the kind of job Eric Anderberg back in Rockford is desperate to fill.
These students could go out and get jobs right away with these skills.
Tom O'Brien teaches computerized machine cutting, design, and robotics at Austin.
Just the other day I heard about there's a shortage of people to service windmills. They can go into engineering sales.
All right, guys, let's put your work back in your folders.
Few of these kids' parents work in manufacturing. Most of those jobs disappeared decades ago, and the factories are now empty hulks. Instead, many are working service jobs at a nursing home, cutting hair, or behind a retail counter. The typical family here makes $33,000, less than half what these kids could ultimately earn with their training and certifications. Desmond Bryant's a senior. He's the one who kept piping up with the answers in class.
To tell you the truth, I never knew of anything about engineering until I came to the school, because I always wanted to do a job with hands-on, but I never could find a right job that could fit me except basketball. I love math. I always loved math. So now that I found the engineer, I was like, yeah, this is me.
What kind of job and wage are you hoping to eventually get?
I hope to get like a 6-figure job that I could keep with my family, a big family. I want a big family.
He comes from a big and supportive family. Dad, Gerald, works security at Austin and coaches the basketball team. A few days later, I visited their well-kept apartment not far from school. Desmond took me on a tour.
Graduation pictures, family pictures, nephews and nieces. Over here is our trophy case. All these trophies is me and my sisters. Running trophies, track trophies, basketball trophies.
That sister is now at Western Illinois University. Desmond's aiming high, too. To be honest, that's the only way he's likely to ever get that six-figure salary. And his parents know it. Dad, Gerald, did 2 years of college. Mom, Gloria, dropped out of high school and works as a nursing assistant.
He's going because there's no options here.
Dad want to be an engineer, and you got to go to college for that. He got plaques in there from school.
Desmond knows what's ahead of him, it's all up to him. We all know, without education, we all up the creek without the paddle.
And I want them better than me when I was coming up. You know, things are harder now. They got the focus.
She says that's the only way her young ones are going to get out of the neighborhood and on in life. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There was a day when the number of women who out-earned their partner was so small the census didn't even track it, all of 25 years ago. Today, 50 million households are headed by women. Reporter Shia Levitt looked into what being the breadwinner means for two women, their relationships, and family.
When Rebecca Kalatis and Lance Brown met, the two earned similar incomes. But Rebecca scored a promotion and another. Now she's a senior staffer for International Planned Parenthood. As the main earner in her home, Rebecca didn't want to be bound by old gender norms. In her parents' generation, being a father and husband was all about providing for the family financially. Rebecca says she fell for Lance, in part for how well he provides for her in ways that matter more.
You know, what I really want in a partner is somebody who can be there for me in the way that he's been there and who can participate in things that matter to me and the things that are important.
They decided jointly for Lance to go back to school and pursue teaching. This way, he could join all Rebecca's prenatal visits and be a stay-at-home dad for a few months. Rebecca's work is flexible, so she hasn't had to sacrifice that much as a mom. She still finds time to breastfeed her 2-year-old and make applesauce popsicles from scratch.
Mama, I take a bite.
You taking a bite? What are you taking a bite of?
Rebecca and Lance are registered as domestic partners. They've been together for almost 8 years, but they still keep separate bank accounts. Much of Lance's income had been on hold during school, so finances have been tricky.
I'm sensitive to him being sensitive to it because I know that in past relationships, he was the person who, you know, kind of provided for the woman in the relationship. And I know it's stressful for him to ask me for money.
Overall, the arrangement is positive, Lance says, but
my sense of frustration was unnecessary delay. I want to contribute. I'm ready to work. I can work, but I have to wait.
The degree took much longer than he hoped. That's been the biggest stress.
Yeah, but I mean, you hate having to ask me for money. And,
well, yeah, and, you know, that's part of it, too. I mean, in the sense that no one wants to feel like they're burdening, they're being a burden or something like that. And you want to be able to just go do something. You don't have to go and say, oh, I need $20 so I can go do this. Or I need money so I can get on the train.
Lance is teaching now and hopes to go full-time soon. But Rebecca will still earn more than twice his starting teacher's salary.
Rebecca makes more. She's the breadwinner. That's the reality and everything. But that's not our focus.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't set out for it to be that way. And it just is that way. And it's not like a big deal. It just is. I mean, there are times when it maybe creates a little stress. But I think that's because money creates stress for everybody and every couple at some point.
As more women out-earn their partners, American family structures and some long-held gender roles are in the midst of dramatic change. Demographer Peter Francis says single women account for part of the rise in women-headed households, but women are primary breadwinners in nearly a third of married couples, too. Just how fast are things changing?
If the trends continue, there's no doubt in my mind that by the 2020 census, or perhaps beforehand, we will see the majority of households in America being headed by women.
One reality for some of these women is career taking some time away from the family.
Did you put everything away? Did you put all the
Playmobil away? Yeah? Really?
I did it.
You did it? Mateo, did you help?
No, he didn't do anything.
Mom Ruby Greenberg in Seattle is getting her four boys ready for dinner as Dad Sebastian finishes cooking.
Come help set the table.
Ruby started her own mortgage business several years ago. As the company grew, the Greenbergs fell into pretty clear roles. She earns the money and he does the rest. Sebastian gets all four boys up and out each morning and takes care of all the meals and groceries. He was a stay-at-home dad full-time for a few years and still manages the home, something his family's had trouble accepting.
Sometimes they ask me, how Ruby's going to get mad with you? She's going to leave you because, you know, you need to bring the money. And it's hard for them to understand that it's working for us.
Ruby's proud of the mortgage company she created, but her career meant she missed out on some things. She remembers when her third son, Mateo, was a few months into his first year of school. Sebastian called.
He said, can you pick Mateo up from preschool today? And I had to Google it. I didn't know where his preschool was. And I was just kind of stunned. It was like this twilight zone of what happened? How do I not know my own son's preschool?
Ruby was always career-driven and never considered being a stay-at-home mom. She says the roles they've chosen have worked for the greater good. But as her kids grow, so does the appeal of swapping duties with her husband.
With each kid, I thought, oh, well, we'll probably have another one. I'll stay home with that one. And then now that it's the last one, it's like, oh, wow. It's not going to happen, is it? I'm going to miss those first steps. And I'm going to miss the first day at preschool. And I'm going to miss all those.
For primary earners like Ruby, there's no easy way to switch places with a partner who's been out of the workforce for a while. When was Sebastian supposed to build a career, she asks, in between naps or diaper changes? Despite sometimes feeling trapped in their roles, she says the arrangement worked well in the big picture, so Ruby continues to shift her schedule in the way she can.
How are you doing, honey? Give me your homework.
Ruby's now trying new hours at the office, starting earlier to make more family time in the evening. So far, it's working. In Brooklyn, I'm Shia Levitt for Marketplace Money.
There is, oh, so much more to this subject, and we're going to dig into it a little more next week with Liza Mundy. She's the author of a new book called The Richer Sex.
We know that women now under 30 who are single in most American cities make more than their male peer group, and they're really trying to figure out how to present themselves on the dating market. And sometimes they will minimize their earnings and adopt all these little strategies to sort of hide their affluence. And some women will lie about what they do. I mean, you know, if they're a lawyer, say that they're a music teacher or a cosmetologist.
Oh, yeah. Much more on that in a week. And now to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is headed to Vegas, and 16-year-old Cyretha Shirley. She recently won a financial literacy contest sponsored by Boys and Girls Clubs of America and the Charles Schwab Foundation. Her winning entry, a rap called Time is Money.
The overall message is basically to inform people, not just kids, it's to let them know about financial responsibility and, you know, teach them, and by what I say, to, you know, focus on your needs and your wants and, you know, things like that, and how to spend your money the right way in a smart way. And that is basically what the message is in the song.
Well, that sounds great. So who's been teaching you those messages?
I got to say that I kind of taught myself, because I just looked at other people and what they did with their money. And it just, you know, kind of motivated me to, you know, spend it the right way, because I saw the outcomes of what they were doing. So I didn't want to be like them, you know, broke or, you know, struggling. So I just said, well, let me go the other way, you know.
That's a great message. So are you, would you say, more of a saver than a spender at this point?
I would say I'm more of a saver, because I always save my money. Every little penny I get, I always want to save it. I hate spending money. I'll spend my mom's money. I'll ask her if she can give me something, but I always save my money. I always save my money as much as I can.
What are you saving for?
Actually, I'm saving for college. You know, I know my mom's going to help out, but I like to do things on my own. I like to be independent. So I want to save my money for college and my car so I don't have to have any, you know, loans or anything like that. I just want to save up as much as I can for what I need when I, you know, get older.
Sounds like a great plan. And did you win some money from this contest?
I did. I won a $500 scholarship.
Woo!
So that's a big help.
Well, I know you already won this contest and the $500 scholarship, but we're going to add to that and send you a Marketplace Money Piggy Award.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And yes, we do have her video at marketplace.org. Boink, boink. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.